I love playing tennis. For the last decade, once a week, my friend Stu and I head down to the tennis court, and there is just something glorious about getting in between those lines with that net there between the two of us and just starting to hit that ball and to watch that ball go back and forth. Everything else is sort of put over on the side, and I am just concentrating on making that serve, on making that cross-court shot. Now, needless to say, when Stu and I play, we have no one watching us, and we do not have any referees. We trust one another. Yeah, that shot was in. That shot was long. Wow, Stu, that was an amazing shot. You got it right there on the line. Your point. Well, next week, in Flushing Meadows, New York, there will be a caliber of tennis that's just a little bit above what Stu and I play. It's called the U.S. Open. The speed, skill, the intensity of the play will be played by the world's top seeds. Names like Andy Murray, Novak Djokovic, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, Milos Raonic. And then that up-and-coming 18-year-old Canadian, this is exciting for Canadian tennis, Denis Shapovalov. They will be there. And I kept looking in the mail for my invitation, but they haven't invited me. Now, there's going to be something else different about the U.S. Open. I call where we play the Stanley Park Invitational. But there in New York, they are also going to have line judges everywhere. Because they're going to need those judges to see that ball was in, that ball was out, that ball was wide. And then sitting there above center court is going to be a man or a woman in a chair, the umpire. And this is the official who oversees any competitive tennis match. He or she will be the living voice, the authoritative word, and their word will be final. Now think about it. You could not imagine the U.S. Open being played without the umpire and without the judges. I'm sure the players would say, if there are no judges and no umpire, we're not playing. Why? Well, if there were not those people there to officiate the game, things could become very confusing. Appeals to the rule book of tennis or past examples or similar situations to refer to would be hopeless. They would not be able to resolve, was it in or out? And now they have that great thing in tennis, that instant replay. And isn't that beautiful when you see that camera just make it absolutely clear if that ball touched the line or not? It is because of, and not in spite of, the authoritative voice of the umpire that they are able to resume play, and those players can play to the best of their ability. In other words, the umpire does not get in the way of the game. The umpire allows for that game to be played in the way it is intended to, so that the viewers are not looking at the umpire, but they're looking at the game. Well, I would like to suggest to you today that just as in tennis or any sport at a high level, you have people officiating, there is a parallel in the Roman Catholic Church. The universal care of souls is entrusted to the Pope, and he is kind of like the church's umpire. The Holy Father is to facilitate the play and the flow of the church's life. Its teaching, its ethics, its morals, its care for the poor, its liturgy, its art. And the point is, his voice is not to shut down the liveliness, his voice is not to get in the way of the game, but to facilitate the game. In the Catechism, there is this very concise description of the Holy Father's authoritative role. Paragraph 937. The Pope enjoys by divine institution. Hear those words, divine institution. In other words, the papacy is not a human invention. It is divinely ordained, as we'll see in a minute. The Pope enjoys by divine institution, supreme, full, immediate, and universal power in the care of souls. So how is it that Roman Catholics can make this claim? How is it that our catechism, written in 1992, promulgated by John Paul II, we are able to say that the Pope enjoys by divine institution supreme, full, immediate, and universal power in the care of souls? Well, to answer that question for you this morning, I want to share with you two texts and one treasure. Two texts and one treasure. And I want to begin with the treasure. After the crucifixion of St. Peter, he was buried right around where the current St. Peter's is today. About 50 years after his death, what is called a necropolis was built there in that part of Rome. A necropolis where tombs, mostly of pagans, but also of some Christians, were buried. The burial of St. Peter in the Vatican is confirmed by very early literary sources. The earliest Christian historian lived in the 3rd century. His name was Eusebius. And listen to what the church's first historian wrote. If you go to the Vatican or to the Ostian Way, you will find the trophies of those who have laid the foundations of this church. Well, who was in the Vatican? St. Peter. Who was along the Ostian Way? St. Paul. The trophies are, of course, referring to their relics. From the earliest times, pilgrims would come to the Vatican to pay their respects to St. Peter. They would go along the Ostian Way to pay their respects to St. Paul. And then in the year 320, the Emperor Constantine built the first basilica where Peter was buried. That basilica stood from 320 until the current St. Peter's. By the way, it took over 100 years to build the current St. Peter's, all of the 16th century and into the early 17th century. And here's the thing that is the treasure. Although it was understood that the relics of St. Peter's were there somewhere, it was only in 1939 that Pope Pius XII said, we better start to excavate that necropolis. And they did. And then in 1941, as they were doing this excavation work, they came across a graffiti wall. And on this wall, in Greek, were the words, Peter in here. They took away the stone, and they found a purple cloth with gold embroidery. They unwrapped the cloth to find bones. Now, because this was 1941, the Second World War, they had to put those bones aside for a while. And it wasn't until the 1950s that through carbon dating, they were able to determine that these were the bones of a man who died somewhere in the 60s of the first century, who was himself in his late 60s or early 70s. From the 4th century, until 1941, these bones had been hidden. But now that this discovery of this amazing treasure had been unearthed, in 1968, Pope Paul VI established the Confessio altar that is below the high altar of St. Peter's, and there are the relics of the first pope. This treasure is one of the most significant Christian archaeological finds of the 20th century. And it confirms the importance that the early church attached to St. Peter. So here's the question. Why was such attention given to his relics so that a basilica has stood on that place since the year 320 called St. Peter's? The answer is simple, really. The earliest generations of Christians understood his importance to the church. They understood that he was the first pope. A designation and responsibility that is indeed divinely instituted, as our catechism says. And how do we know that it's divinely instituted? Well, let's turn now from our one treasure to our two texts, starting with that passage from Matthew 16. So here's a little background to Matthew's gospel. You need to understand this to understand the significance of this passage. There are four gospels in the New Testament. Matthew is the one that is most Jewish. Matthew makes it very clear at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus is the new Moses. For Jesus says, "I have not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it." And just as Moses had the five books of the law, what we call the Pentateuch, so too Matthew divides his gospel into five main teaching sections. We know this because there is a literary genre where it says, after Jesus had said these things, that is said five times to divide the book into these different sections. In chapters 16 to 18, where today's reading is from, we have the word church used twice. There is nowhere else in the Gospels. You won't find it in Mark, you won't find it in Luke, you won't find it in John, the word church. The only place you find it is in Matthew 16 and Matthew 18. So what is it that Matthew is wanting us to see? That Jesus is the new Moses, and he is establishing a new temple with a new cornerstone or foundation. Remember what he said. After Simon, son of Jonah, said, "You are the Christ," giving to Jesus a title that defines his office as the Messiah, Jesus in turn says, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, you are Peter." And it's not so much that Jesus, was just giving him a new name, he was giving him a title, Peter, a word in Aramaic and in Greek that means rock. Now, why did Jesus call Peter the rock? Well, let me explain it to you the following way. In the Old Testament, they understood that the temple was built on a rock, a foundation stone, and this foundation stone was over the portal that led down to Hades, the place of the dead. And this place, this realm of the dead, is a place where souls would be detained until the last judgment. Hades is the habitation of evil forces that bring about death and deception. And so I want you to picture this in your mind. This is what the Jewish people understood. The foundation stone, the rock of the temple, covered the hole down to Hades. Now think about this. When Jesus says to Simon, son of Jonah, "You are the rock, you are the foundation," he's not only saying, "You are the foundation that now helps to keep Hades from influencing the world, but you are the very foundation of the second temple." It's no longer the Jerusalem temple, it is now the temple of the church, and because of the vocation you have, the gates of Hades will never be able to prevail against the church. Do you see the significance of this? Jesus, in accepting the title from Peter, "I am, yes, the Christ, the Messiah," gives to Simon a title, "You are the rock, you are the foundation on which I will build my church." Now, with that in mind, what about the keys? They symbolize the teaching authority of Peter. Jesus consecrates Peter as the church's chief teacher, whose office will continue through his successors. And this is where we have to go back now to our second text, the passage from Isaiah 22. And here we're reading about the time of King Hezekiah. He was the king 600 years before Jesus came. And he had a steward who had authority for his household, what we might call like a prime minister. And the thing is, some of these men were good men, some of them were bad men. The man who currently held the office was a man named Shebna. And God has said to Isaiah, I want you to fire that man. He is doing an awful job. And so we hear in today's text, thus says the Lord, go and say to Shebna the following. And let me read to you again what Isaiah says to Shebna, who's about to be fired. So this is like his pink slip. I will commit your authority to his hand. That is to the person who's going to come after you, a man by the name of Eliakim. And what kind of a steward, what kind of a prime minister will Eliakim be? Well, listen. He shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. I will place on his shoulder the key of the house of David. He shall open and no one will shut. He will shut and no one shall open. I will fasten him like a peg in a secure place, and he will become a throne of honor to his ancestral home. Do you hear what's being said here? We're not having a reference to the king. That's Hezekiah. But this is the king's right-hand man. And he is given the keys of authority, the very thing Jesus gives to Simon, son of Jonah, in Matthew 16. I give you the keys. And Jesus had Isaiah 22 in mind. What does this teach us? That Jesus ordained the papacy. Jesus ordained the papacy to be that rock whereby the church of God would be built up and the influence of Hades would be arrested. Jesus intended for the papacy to be the means by which the vicar of Christ would continue to be the steward, not of his own household, but of Jesus' household, the church. And so, as I conclude this homily, we are thankful that when we, as Roman Catholics, think about our faith, we realize that there are high stakes involved here. This is even more significant than the U.S. Open, because this has to do with life and death, hell and eternity, judgment and grace. And would God leave the umpire chair empty? That would be foolish. And of course he would not. So my Roman Catholic brothers and sisters, may we in humble thanksgiving thank Jesus that he instituted the papacy. Thank Jesus that the papacy is the most unbroken institution in the world. Thank Jesus that in the 20th century, the relics of St. Peter were discovered. Thank Jesus that because we are a church that is structured with an authority, we can play the game of life with a freedom and with a purpose and with a confidence, because we're not having to figure out all the rules by ourselves. We have one whom Jesus has entrusted with that role. Thanks be to God for his one holy Catholic and apostolic church.